Welcome everyone to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is one of the devs on the highly acclaimed indie sensation, Dredge. You may have heard of it. They recently released their newest DLC, The Iron Rig. I'd like to welcome Joel Mason. How you doing, man?
Hey, I'm good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for taking time out of your day. Enjoying the fruits of your labor, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's always work to do, though.
Never stops.
No.
So I'm interested in the concept of Dredge and how it actually came about, this whole cosmic horror fishing game.
Yeah, so when we started Black Salt Games, we began a prototyping phase of figuring out the game that we were going to make. And Dredge was just one of those pitches. But that pitch, it's really hard to talk about the concept of an idea and like where did an idea come from. I mean, I can try to distill it, I suppose, but I do think about Dredge as being like a very fortuitous thing that just sort of popped into my head one day. It came about like from me wanting to make a fishing mini game into a full experience. Like I love fishing mini games in other games like Red Dead Redemption and Stardew Valley, and you know it's a pretty ubiquitous mechanic. But I wanted to see if it could turn into a full experience. And as I started writing that sort of one page pitch for Dredge, the idea of it being a horror or an atmospheric game just sort of felt like it came really naturally. You've got things like Lovecraft and the cosmic horror influence. And when you're designing obstacles for the player, you know, krakens and eldritch things just fits the nautical theme. And then we sort of leaned into that. And when we prototyped it, we found it was just really effective at grabbing players' attention.
So was the visual you had in your head what ended up in the prototype?
No, the visual I had in my head as a programmer, I'm very like logic based, and the pitch that I presented to the team was a top down, turn based, grid based game where you're like navigating a map, and you're saying, right, I'm going to go over here and get these mackerel, and I'm going to spend my units of time to move around the grid, all very like board gamey, very sort of logical, and. You know, part of prototyping is transforming the game to where it needs to be. And thankfully, Alex, who is our creative director and our lead artist, saw that it could be turned into a more free-flowing exploration game. And that was what we prototyped. And I'm glad we did because it turned out pretty good.
Yeah, and how did you settle on the art style?
So... That was chosen by Alex again, and I think part of it was born out of a necessity and scope. So Black Salt Games started out as three people: myself, the programmer, Alex, the artist, and Nadia, our producer. And we didn't have a whole lot of time and a whole lot of money, and we knew we needed to make something. So, you know, with that kind of constraint, you start aiming pretty low with the with your concept, I suppose. And it's certainly when prototyping, you're not modeling things in great detail. So
no.
When Alex was modeling, he went very low poly, I suppose, with the prototype. And that actually turned out to be really effective as a juxtaposition between this kind of cutesy art style and these horror elements that we'd thrown in there. The dichotomy we have between the gameplay experience during the day and night was just sort of more accentuated by that cutesy low poly style. And when we took it into production and started making like real art assets, we kept a lot of that through. It's like it's best thought of as low poly. It's not actually as low poly as you might think. The cliffs and stuff all have like little facets and stuff that create these sort of sharp edges and sort of rough textures. But people think of it as low poly, which is good enough.
Yeah. What was the most difficult mechanic to implement, personally? I mean, you're the programmer, so You would know.
Gosh, I think there's a few, and for different reasons. There's things like the spatial inventory. So in dredge, when you're going out and catching fish, you don't just have like an encumbrance or a weight limit of how many fish you can hold, but you have a physical inventory where you have to slot this fish into it. And different fish have different shapes. And that was one of our sort of core gameplay mechanics, this little inventory Tetris puzzle that you do. And that was cool, and players liked it, but it had a lot of sort of design ramifications later down the line, because let's say you go and you hand in an item and you get a reward for a quest. Most other games would just sort of add that item to your inventory, whereas we always allow the player to organize their inventory, and because that's such a big part of it, at the time where the player gets given this item, we have to bring in this grid and we have to allow the player to organize it. We also have to allow the player to say, oh, I actually can't fit that right now. I'll come back later. So you have all of these extra pieces of dialogue that happen in really sort of edge case scenarios. So that's sort of how the spatial inventory system just has all of these knock-on effects. And the other large area, of course, is that it is a game set entirely on the water, and water has a number of considerations like physics and waves and transparency, which is a bit of a difficult thing on some hardware. It's not a perfectly simulated ocean. There are waves, but there are no the waves can't push you up onto the shore and beat you, which sounds like it might be a cool thing, but actually is really frustrating to just sort of be walking around and just get stuck, essentially. It creates all of these other things, like if you're sort of running around in, say, a Zelda game, which is a very sort of big open world game, it's quite easy for them to sort of hide pieces of gameplay or things to find around the map. But on the water, you have to construct an island to then put something in it. You can't really hide things to find just floating on a flat ocean. So the design of the world as well is affected by the fact that it's a water-based game.
I know Breath of the Wild slightly influenced the world, but with that being said, was there any influence from Wind Waker, considering that that takes place on the water as well?
I mean, I'm ashamed to say I've never played Wind Waker, so...
Okay, well then
certainly
clearly
not from me. It's possible that Alex played it, I don't recall, and that could have influenced him there. It's certainly an influence that we get, that people call out to us, and perhaps that's why it was successful, because it's such a much-loved game.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and part of the reason is you're doing stylized graphics as well, so you can get away with things. The minute you go into realism, then people start pinpointing everything exactly, right?
That's exactly it. And again, another sort of scope choice, right? Like, we didn't have time to animate all of these characters. We didn't have time to do all of these things, and therefore a low poly sort of pulls people's expectations down a little bit to where, like, we were able to deliver. I think that helps.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but the inventory system was inspired by Resident Evil 4, and you don't even play horror games, do you?
Well, again, I haven't played Resident Evil 4. I think when we sort of announced and started showing the spatial inventory, people said, oh, it's like Resident Evil 4. And that was maybe the first we'd heard of it, because I think there's also a fish item in RE4 that
you can carry
through or something. And we're like, oh, gosh, is that, have we like stolen something here? And I think as well, the RE4 remake came out a week before Dredge came out, which was even more like serendipitous. And we actually saw some streamers who would sort of spend an hour playing RE4 and then they would move over to Dredge, like, as part of their stream schedule. Like, it was such a funny transition. But yeah, people like spatial inventories with fish in them.
Yeah, yeah. Because I did wonder, maybe if you hadn't played the game, then you'd seen trailers or gameplay footage or something and that influenced, or is it just one of those things that I don't know, just everything's copied from something, I guess.
Yeah, it's so hard to pull apart where you've been influenced from. Like, I've never read any Lovecraft, but the game is very cosmic horror, which is a term that really Lovecraft started. And Lovecraft has influenced a whole bunch of other games, like, say, Darkest Dungeon. And I would say Darkest Dungeon has influenced Dredge, certainly with some of the early prototype character portraits. They were much more like, they had thick outlines and sort of that kind of style. Influences come from all over the place.
Mm. So where did the panic eye come from?
I guess it was just like it's kind of like your health bar, but different.
Yeah.
Right. And so we had the idea that there would be stuff out in the world that happens to you that is weird, like monsters spawn and chase you and these other things. We call them world events, can just happen to you while you're out on the water. But it didn't feel right for them to just be like entirely random. It would be unfair for people to just be sailing along and then this really bad thing happens and they get eaten. They need to deserve it, right? And that's through sort of mismanagement of their resources. In this case, your mental state is your resource. By staying out at night, you are draining your resource of sanity. And then at lower sanity levels, you're risking all of these sort of terrible things happening. And at certain levels, if you go into super deep water and you're, you know, very panicked, then yeah, you might get chomped by a big thing.
That seems like a mechanic that you'd have to play test thoroughly to get it right, I would think.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of, as with every game, there's certain bars and meters and numbers that need tweaking over time. And speaking of which, time, the passage of time was one that was tweaked, probably more than sanity. So in Dredge, as you're sailing around, the in-game clock advances. If you stop moving, it actually time stops. So you can sort of look around and plan your next fishing trip, I suppose. So time moves quite quickly. I think it's a day in game might be something like a minute or 80 seconds if you're just sailing straight. So it's really, really quick. And it used to be a lot faster. It used to be like, I don't know, 30 seconds for a day. And it's through playtesting that we find this feedback and we sort of reach a level that we're happy with. People always want the game's time to move slower. They want more nice, relaxing daytime. But it's about finding a balance between those players. You can't quite give them the experience they want. You have to sort of pull it back to make it a little bit of a challenge for them.
Yeah, because you've had fans want multiplayer and you're like, no, we're not doing that.
That's right. Yeah, that's we've certainly had a lot of requests and there is in fact a mod for multiplayer, which is quite amusing and flattering, really. For us, the experience is very like solo. The themes are sort of isolation and sort of this really close and tense atmosphere. And that's, I think, part of what makes Dredge interesting. And to have your mate sort of sailing alongside you, blasting his foghorn, I think might ruin those moments. Not to say it isn't fun, but it's a different kind of experience.
Well, wouldn't that be hard to do on something like Switch anyway? I mean, it's nearing its limit. And I know you were like running into a few problems, particularly later on. And I don't know if it was the same with the DLC.
I've never programmed a multiplayer game, so I actually couldn't tell you how difficult it is. It's more difficult than not doing it. Obviously, Switch has multiplayer games, so somebody must have figured it out. But some of the pieces of hardware struggle. You know, it's part of supporting systems that are just old or older now. But we make it work just about.
Well, the whole game is, or any type of game development, there's always limitations. I mean, in your case, you had a whole bunch of limitations, and you had to find creative ways of solving them. So in some ways it's good, right? When you've got, when you're presented with a roadblock, you just find a way to navigate around it.
Yeah, and fortuitously the game sort of revolves around this approaching fog that can influence the player's vision, and being able to obscure distant islands with fog and then have them render as lower resolution as a result is going to help with that.
Yeah, fair enough. How did you settle on the biomes? Was this a whiteboard thing where you're just like mangroves, volcano,
like
ice?
Literally, really? Yeah, exactly that. So as part of the, okay, let's take this game to production process, once we had settled on we were going to do Dredge, we sort of take a step back and think, right, what is this game going to look like when it's more than just a 20-minute prototype? Where can we take this? And there were all sorts of things considered. You know, there were angles of it being more of a fishing management game, which I think doesn't really exist. But it turned into an exploration game, and it was the discussion of, right, where can we take this? It was literally sort of the more video game trope things of, there's going to be a volcano, there's going to be an ice level, there's going to be a jungle level. There were a few that were cut. Ice was cut and was later re-added as a DLC. And I say cut, like we never developed it. It was just a thing that we
an
just
idea
didn't
that you put
do.
To the side. Yeah.
Yeah. There was sort of a jungle level. I don't think I've talked about this on a podcast yet. There was sort of a jungle level that was sort of surrounded by islands, and this civilization had developed like a series of locks to sort of lower the water level inside it, and it was almost like dry land inside this sort of circle. And there was going to be some kind of mechanic around like raising and lowering the locks and the water level. That eventually turned into a more maze-like mangrove in Twisted Strand, which we have. It was some sort of basic biomes, but they all change over time.
How many did you list on the whiteboard? Do you remember?
I don't remember. It was probably like five or six, and then we did five.
So you were always settling on five biomes to have?
It just felt like it made up a map with the zone in the middle and then sort of four corners. Again, we're always thinking about like the scope and how much can we achieve in the amount of time we have. And we were sort of estimating, well, this area might take us this many months, therefore we can do like four more of them. That's kind of our thought process.
But every biome would take you a different amount of time to complete. Surely.
But only because we get faster over time. So the first biome involved figuring out a lot of the fishing mechanics and how does a conversation with somebody work and how do I program this? So the marrows, the first area, took, I don't know, 8 months. And then the next one took 4 months, and then so on. It sort of gets quicker and quicker. It reaches a point where it's not going to get any faster, as you just have to do all this modeling and texturing and all of these things. But it became slightly more predictable for us developing them.
I've spoken to a lot of devs, and they have a bit of a problem with feature creep, where they just want to keep stuffing stuff into the game.
Yeah.
Did you run into that problem, or did you have like a firm hand to be like, no, we are not doing this. We'll save it for the next game.
So we do have a firm hand, and her name is Nadia, and she's very good at keeping us under control. But I don't know if I would call, I mean, I guess it is. I don't like to think of feature creep as a problem. It is something to keep, to be aware of. But like ideas come at you at all sorts of different times. They're not necessarily all going to be there ahead of development. So you develop an idea, you play it, you play test it, and then you think of other ways that it can interact and improve your game. So it's just a matter of keeping on track of how much you do add. and remembering that the point of making games is to release them normally. Yeah.
Well, that's the problem with feature creep usually.
Yeah.
It delays a game inevitably. And I suppose in your case, you had a certain period where you had to get this done.
Exactly. And that was always our focus. And again, I think like when we set out to build Drage, we didn't expect it to be a success. We expected sort of realistically what we were going to get from Drage was a whole lot of learnings for us to build the next game better. And that's sort of how we approached it. We tried a lot of different things with the intention to just learn. And we were very lucky that Dredge also did really well critically and commercially.
That must have been nervous when you first released it, because you have no idea, no one does really, what the reviews are going to be like, how it's going to sell.
Yeah, there were different stages of nerves, I think. We had a review embargo that was, I think, lifted a week before launch, which I think was probably quite generous. The reviews were very positive at that point. So that was kind of when nerves started going down a little for us. I remember waking up, I think 4 a.m. New Zealand time, and just scrolling through the Metacritic, because that was when the reviews went up, and just seeing like green numbers. And I just went back to sleep. I was happy.
Yeah.
Because I saw they were in like the 80s. And that was more than I expected. But there was also the moment when we released the demo in the Steam Next Fest, and we got, I think, 70,000 players, which was way more than we thought. And a lot of the feedback was really good. We had an in-game feedback form where people could submit bugs and suggestions and all of these things. I think we got 1,000 tickets through to us, and half of them were just like, good game, thanks. And we were just like really happy with that kind of level of response. So nerves went down, but they were still always very much there.
Yeah. So how did the film adaptation come about?
Obviously,
it's still in production. That's like,
it's wild.
Mind-boggling. Yeah, it's wild.
Oh, entirely. I think maybe 2 months after launch, we got our first email from a film studio saying we want to make a Drage movie, and I'm pretty sure we all thought it was a prank.
Yeah, I bet.
But they also kept coming. We got a few of them. We got a number of production studios who were interested, and we suddenly had to figure out how the Hollywood world worked and upskill ourselves in various things. You know, we're not lawyers yet, but we had to hire a lawyer and all of those things. We chatted to a bunch of them, met a bunch of them, and we landed with Story Kitchen, who we believed would be best suited to getting the Drage movie made, which is a crazy sentence to say.
That's so wild, because I wouldn't think that it's that common. I've spoken to a lot of devs, and I don't know if it's a common thing. I don't know if you've spoken to a number of devs where this is a common thing, where they launch a game.
More common.
Well, I know that video game adaptations for a long time were bad.
Certainly.
Until recently, and you know, the Mario film and the Sonic film, and even Last of Us and the Fallout TV show.
And there's still the potential for them to be bad.
There is, but you're more hopeful, right? Because you've seen the good ones, right? Because they used to be just all bad. Well, like 95% of them were bad. So are you having like a hand in terms of like the script at all?
Yes, sort of. I'm not qualified to write a script. Certainly.
No, but you're assisting maybe in the story or the basic writing. Yeah.
Yeah, it's important to us that the movie respects the lore of Drage, it does have a pretty established lore and an established world, even though the game doesn't surface a whole bunch of that. Like it is there for the people that really go digging, and people have gone digging, and there are plenty of YouTube videos out there breaking it all down, and a lot of them are very, very accurate considering how vague we are. So it's important to us that we hold a lot of that stuff to be true for the movie. Yeah.
So when you say you had to learn about Hollywood, like, in what way? Were you reaching out to people you know that have been in that system?
Yeah, we have been doing that. Oh, it's things like how do movie signing deals work? Who gets rights? What do rights mean? What happens first? You get a director first. You get a writer first. You get actors first. There's all kinds of different ways of doing this that are too complicated and out of my expertise. So yeah,
you didn't reach out to Peter Jackson or Weta or something. New Zealand's small.
I don't remember. We reached out to a lot of people. It's possible we did.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. That's funny. So the evolution of the fishing mechanic, can you explain to me how that came about and whether it stayed the same or how it evolved?
So the fishing mechanic in Dredge is this little mini game where a thing spins around a reel and you have to interact when it's over a little green area. So you've got to like hit these little notches on the fishing reel. And if you hit them, you get closer to catching the fish.
Yeah.
But also, as the thing spins around, you are just catching the fish passively. You can take your hands off the keyboard and the fish will catch itself over time. It's just not particularly optimal. And if you remember what I said before about time being like one of your resources, time passes when you are fishing. And if you spend 5 hours catching a cod and it's turned to nighttime, bad things can happen at nighttime. Mm. So you want to be kind of optimal. You want to play this little mini game. But at the same time, I've played so many games that have frustrating fishing mini games. I have a mate with cerebral palsy, and he like cannot interact with the fishing mini game in Stardew Valley because it's so sort of motor skill intensive, and that sucks. So one of our goals was to make the fishing mini game not frustrating and to make it accessible to players. The game has a lot of fishing in it, right? You might spend 10 hours, and you're doing a lot of fishing as part of that 10 hours. By making the fishing mini game kind of simple and trivial and slightly ignorable, we hoped it wouldn't get in people's way. And when we were sort of doing our sort of final rounds of playtesting the full game, which takes a long time, some players remarked that, oh, I was maybe a bit tired of the fishing mini game by the end of it. Some didn't seem to mind. But we had always thought that maybe we should have some variations of the fishing mini game. We thought maybe we would do it in a post-release update to sort of, you know, freshen things up a little bit. But we did end up sneaking it in sort of a month or two before release. So the game released with, I think, five different fishing, or maybe four different fishing mini games. So as you're going through the areas, things change a little bit and it keeps it a little more interesting.
Mm. Talk to me about the ending. How far did that come about? the two different endings.
Yes. Yeah,
was it always planned as two different endings, or were you going to have one, or was there like five different endings?
Gosh, it's actually hard to remember. I do remember that the story outline came from Alex. He went for a walk one day and then came back an hour later and said, right, I've got this story idea. But this is very early in development when we didn't have anything necessarily locked in. It's hard to talk about it without spoiling it.
Incredibly. Yeah, yeah.
There is a twist in the story, and I love the twist, and I think a lot of other people love the twist, and that came from this walk that Alex took, and I'm very thankful he took it. So that was very early on, really, and we were sort of building towards that over a year and a half.
Sorry, I was just going to ask, like, the ending, though, did you actually have an ending at that point before Alex did that walk? And then did it change? Or you guys had, like, just a vague idea of what you were going to do, and then post-walk, you knew how to implemented?
I think we knew the end was going to be something bad, sort of like on a world scale. But I don't think we knew how to really sell it narratively. I think we had talked about maybe letting the player like try to fight back or something, but it didn't really fit, and it just didn't seem right. So I don't think we had a solid ending. But again, it's been 3 years. I can't actually remember exactly.
But it's a cool twist. So
it is. And we did and ah about the alternate ending, which you could call the good ending.
It's not really, though.
It's an ending.
it's another ending. Bad and worse.
Yeah. And we wanted to make it a little bit hidden. But we didn't want to like hide it completely. And we make it available if you do a certain few things in a certain different order. It's surprising. A lot of people actually get the alternate ending before they see the sort of main ending, which it's fine. People have different experiences with the game and they talk about them online, and that's part of what makes gaming fun.
Yeah.
I think to talk about what you did and what happened for you.
Totally. But so when you're writing the story, like how many iterations of the story are you doing? Because I imagine you don't write what the conclusion's going to be or the intro or how the narrative is and just stick 100% to it. There must be evolution of it as time goes on.
Certainly in the first few months, there were a few evolutions and rewrites, but also there was not a lot that was written, so the rewrites weren't a big deal because we were still only in the first zone, and a lot of the lines that characters were talking about are just sort of really vague, cryptic tone-setting lines, and they didn't have to really change. But the overall structure did go through some rewrites. I'm talking about things like, why are you doing the things that you are doing? Like, who is sending you out to fetch these things? What do they want with it? Those sort of more hidden structural elements. They went through some rewrites early on. But again, post Alex's walk, we had pretty much locked in. And then it was just a matter of going through each biome as we developed them clockwise around the map, saying like, right, how is this going to feed into that main structure?
Yeah, makes sense. How did the Leviathan come into it? Why a Leviathan?
I think I don't remember where the Leviathan came from. I mean, it is a sort of mysterious and complex force in the world, I suppose. I have to be careful about like not confirming or disconfirming any specific lore items.
No.
People in our Discord will be all over me.
But like even in terms of how it's implemented, right? A lot of these open world games, when you get to the edge, they'll have text that says you can go no further.
We've got that.
Yeah, you do have that, but like the Leviathan kind of works into that as well.
Yes. And in fact, in the demo, it worked differently because I don't think we had the Leviathan at that point. In the demo, you get teleported back to the center of the world if you reach the end. That was a little out of bounds mechanic there, but yeah, I mean you have this character in the Leviathan that has a role in the, I'll say, ecosystem, and it was just kind of fortuitous that we could, I'm trying not to spoil anything, we could deploy him in a way that fits with his role and what he's trying to do and what he's trying to make you do. So that's how he works then, I guess.
That would have gone through a lot of iteration, I'm sure.
No, actually, I don't think
really?
It did. I think it was just, hey, somebody had a cool idea and it kind of fits and it works, and we have this problem of what do we do when people just sail off for 10 minutes in one direction, and here's a solution that happened to work. Not to say there weren't bugs involved with it. Like,
Of course. I imagine programming it would be a nightmare.
Yeah, like if you sail too far and then the Leviathan is coming up and then you teleport, I think he teleported with you at some point and then would just continue to eat you. You know, all kinds of fun things.
Yeah. Was it always planned to be as big as it was? Was it smaller, larger?
The Leviathan?
Yeah.
I mean, it's infinitely long.
Yeah.
It was always planned to be that big. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good to know.
Yeah. It is, I believe, the most complex model in the game because it is so large.
Yeah, yeah. So the Iron Rig DLC, how did that come about? Were you thinking about that during the initial development, or was it an idea that came up post-release?
So, I don't think we were seriously thinking about much DLC during development because, again, we didn't expect it to succeed. We expected to be moving on to the next game, whatever it may be. And in fact, we did. In the month leading up to launch, we were prototyping other games. But then launch month got crazy and we had to sort of drop that and pivot back. So launch was a great success and we were watching players play and listening to all their feedback. And one of the main pieces of feedback was, I loved it. I wish it was longer. And we wanted to come up with some content that felt like it could flesh out some of the mechanics that we maybe didn't have time to flesh out as much as we wanted. So making, like giving players tools to make fishing easier and more interesting. And we also heard a lot of players wanted to like construct a town. There's a little quest in the main game where you're helping a builder build a house for themselves. And players, I think, latched onto that and thought, oh, I want to build my own dock and I want to be able to put things in it. So we sort of combined those things into the Iron Rig, which is a large destination that players can sort of deliver resources to and unlock new buildings. And those buildings will unlock new items that allow players to fish in different ways, that allow players to sort of target fish in new ways. But the Iron Rig was supposed to be our first DLC. So we came out of launch and we planned the Iron Rig and we had even announced, I think, via a PlayStation blog that there would be some free updates and then a DLC, like a big expansion in 2023. And then we got further and further into development and it got later and later in the year and we realized we probably weren't going to hit the promise of content in 2023, at least not to the level that we wanted it to be. So we actually shelved the Iron Rig temporarily and then brought the ice biome off the cutting room floor and created the Pale Reach, which ended up being our first DLC, which is a sort of standalone area that tells its own little story in an ice area. And then we returned to the Iron Rig once we had made good on that promise of content in 2023.
So is that it now? Are you done or are you going to do more DLC?
We're currently the aim is to currently look at bringing Dredge to audiences that currently don't have access to Dredge. I cannot predict the future and I will never say never about anything other than perhaps multiplayer. I'll never do multiplayer in Dredge. But that's our focus at the moment.
So you mentioned before that you started, prototyping another game. So have you kind of taken up where you left off or is that still somewhere?
Not at the moment. No, I mean, at the moment, we're literally still like doing bug fix patches and stuff for Dredge because the Iron Rig is only sort of a month old now.
Yeah.
So we're still in sort of tidy up maintenance mode. But when we were doing prototypes back in March 2023, leading up to Dredge's launch, we had a few ideas again. We were going through the same sort of process of spending a few weeks on things and then testing them, seeing what they're like. And then all hell broke loose when Dredge released and those ideas got shelved. I think when we revisit them, we will be assessing them through a different lens a little bit, because when we were originally working on them, we didn't have a hit game on our hands, and we had perhaps constructed a box that was a little bit smaller and sort of reflects that. But perhaps we will aim our sights a little higher when we do start prototyping whatever's next.
Because there were three of you. How many are on the team now at Black Salt?
Yeah, so about halfway through Dredge, we hired Mikey, who is a 3D artist, modeler, animator. And so, yeah, the team to launch was myself, Alex, Mikey, and Nadia. And then since then, we have brought in a few contractor friends to help us, because the QA got quite large. It's hard to test the game in its current size in every platform now, and that was riding on Nadia. And she's busy being a producer and all sorts of other things too. So yeah, we have some additional help, and we have some community folks that are helping us manage our growing Discord and subreddit and all of those things.
Yeah. What was the hardest thing from a programming standpoint? Main game, Pale Reach, Iron Rig. What's the thing that you found the hardest from a programming standpoint? And was it at any time you're like, oh, I'm out of my depth here?
Oh, I felt out of my depth from day one, because I'd come from a studio where I'd always been in a team. And if you're, you know, if anyone's programmed before, they'll know that sometimes you just hit a brick wall and there's something you just can't figure out. There might be a simple solution, but you just can't find it. And being able to bounce ideas off people's heads is a great tool for that. And not having somebody as a solo programmer was... Yeah, it was intimidating to start with. It did have some advantages, I think, in that, you know, I knew the whole code base. So if a feature needed to be done, I could vaguely remember everything that I had done. It also means that every bug is my fault, basically. but thankfully, Alex is actually, he's a tech artist. He knows a bit of code, so having somebody technical like him to talk to is invaluable for that as well.
Yeah, because you are the main programmer, from what I understand, the main programmer and the main writer, but you did have some hand in some of the design as well, and vice versa. Like, you kind of all overlapped. Yeah,
very much so. It's hard not to in such a small team. Like the original pitch might have been mine, but as I said, it was a grid based turn-based game, so my design was molded through all of us, as was every addition that we made to the game. You know, trawling came in 6 months into the game, and that was an idea that we all discussed, because it involves all of us. You know, someone's got to program it, someone's got to do the art, someone's got to do the animation, so yeah, it's a very collaborative design process.
Usually with devs that I've spoken to, by the time they reach the end of development, because they've QA'd it to high heaven, they're over the game. Have you reached that point yet, or are you still like,
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't play Dredge for fun. Like, it made me a little bit sad, because, you know, it's the kind of game I've always wanted to make for myself, but I have played it enough now. I don't need to play it anymore.
Well, I suppose you'll come back to it in retrospective in like 10 years or something, and then you'll probably enjoy it and be like, yeah, I made this. This is cool.
Perhaps. And I do get a lot of joy from watching other people play it as well. I think seeing people experience the moments and the emotions that we hoped they would experience is really incredible. But yeah, I don't begrudge Dredge. I'm happy to be sick of it after thousands of hours of playing it.
Well, yeah, if you weren't, I'd be quite surprised. Yeah. I think it's quite common, I think, if you're working on it, particularly for creative people, because you might just want to move on to the next creative thing, whatever that is.
I don't know. I literally don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Not multiplayer, obviously.
Probably not. I think it's, again, I can't predict the future. I think it's safe to say that whatever comes next is probably gonna feel like Dredge. It's probably not gonna be a boat game, you know, but it's gonna have a lot of the same DNA, which is a very vague answer, but I think our fans would expect that, and I think it's still an area that we want to be making games in.
Well, the interesting thing is there'll be more expectations on you next time with your next game as well, right? Because Dredge has laid the groundwork. It's been praised. So now there's pressure that you have to deliver with your second game.
I can understand perhaps why Team Cherry are taking so long with Silksong, because they have a lot of pressure on them. And I can see how that can influence. I'm beginning to see how that can influence developers. It's something we will have to wrestle with during our next game's development. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, all the best with it. It's cool to see the success story, like with you guys and you know, Path of Exile and stuff. So wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Yeah, you totally destroyed your estimates, and hopefully that continues.
Yeah, no, just so fortunate to be in a position where we can, you know, sort of choose what we want to do next, choose what we want to make. And I think we can make something that lives up to Dredge.
Yeah. And I suppose the sales, like, they would have spiked and then come down and then.
Yeah, I do like looking at the graphs, and it is something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, hey, I'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for sparing me your time. And people can follow you. You're on pretty much every social media platform, and you got your own Discord and all that jazz.
Right. Yeah, you can join our Dredge Discord or the subreddit, or you can follow me on Twitter at BSG_Joel.
Cool. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.